Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello, good evening. My name is Descartes Lee, and welcome to the UCSF Mini Medical School. This is the starting talk of a series of six regarding, well, entitled The Science of the Mind. And I'm very pleased to be the chairperson for this series. I'm going to be talking today, this evening, and then we have a great lineup of other speakers coming up in the following Tuesday evenings. We have, we're going to be talking about the biology of stress and depression. We're going to be talking about psychotherapy. What is it? What does it do? Should you get it? We'll be talking about motivation and reward. What keeps us going? Why do we do what we do? Mindfulness, meditation. And then finally, last but not least, we'll have a really interesting talk about anxiety and anxiety disorders. So I'm a professor of psychiatry at the Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute, which serves as the UCSF Department of Psychiatry. I'm the chief of our bipolar disorder program, and I also direct the UCSF Electroconvulsive Therapy Service. So, but that's it for introductions. I'm today going to talk to you about alternative treatments for depression. Do they work? And so I don't have much of a claim to fame about knowing a huge amount about alternative treatments. As my titles may indicate, I tend to be someone who's more interested in bipolar disorder and electroconvulsive therapy. But these alternative treatments for depression comes up a lot in everyday life as well as in my own work. And so I thought this would be a great opportunity to review some of the literature and to talk a little bit more about it. Now, there's something I just want to say here. There's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and it's worth fighting for. And that's an indicator that I feel strongly about staying free of commercial bias. This is something that's come up in academic circles these days. In fact, not long ago, I got a call from a representative from a pharmaceutical company wanting me to give a talk on one of their products. And I said, you know, I really can't do that. It's clearly a conflict of interest, and it's against my ethical principles. And the person at the other end said, well, that's too bad, because we're going to offer you a speaker's fee of $5,000. And I said, hold on a second. Let me get Dr. Lee on the line for you. Unfortunately, I was too late. Now, the world of complementary and alternative treatments is huge. There are many treatments out there. So I decided today would be to focus on just a few of these treatments. Exercise, placebos is not quite a treatment, but I'll get into that when I get to that point. I'll talk about omega-3 fatty acids and S-adenosylmethionine will be the last ones. But I will talk about these more in detail, but as I go along, hopefully I can convey some of the important methods or attitudes one should have when critically looking at these kinds of treatments. And when you're reading about these kinds of treatments, what kinds of things should you be looking for and thinking about? So the old quote is, you know, you give a person a fish and you feed them for a day. Well, I want to teach a person a fish so you can feed yourselves for a lifetime. These are some other alternative treatments, which I won't be talking about today. But maybe at the end, if we have questions, we can touch on them. And MBSR stands for Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, which Dr. Stuart Eisendrath will be talking about in a few weeks. I just want to say a word about what are non-alternative treatments? Those are the standard treatments. And those, in general, for depression, the non-alternative treatments these days tends to be antidepressants. And there's been a lot of controversy recently. How many of you have heard of this article in the New York Review of Books by Marcia Angell, The Crazy State of Psychiatry? Has anyone heard of it? So she wrote a review about these three books that really kind of looked at very critically the usage of antidepressants in contemporary society or contemporary U.S. society. So if you ever have a chance to read that article, It's definitely shorter than the three books combined. Now, a couple of the things I wanted to mention, and these will come up also in terms of looking at alternative treatments, actually, is this issue of generalizability of findings, meaning how representative, if there's a study of a certain treatment, they do it on people, and how representative are these people to typical people that we that either we are or that we might treat or advise people about. So, for example, in this one study, looking at 346 patients, only 12% of them would actually have been eligible for a typical research study. And those kinds of things are like, you can't have have an anxiety disorder, you can't have used certain substances within a certain period, you can't be depressed for too long a period, you can't be depressed for too short a period, like 8 weeks, you have to be depressed at least 8 weeks, no more than 12 months. Oops, sorry about that. Thank you. And you can't be depressed for a certain amount of time also. So you really actually in many studies really are limited in terms of the numbers of the kinds of patients that are seen sometimes in the studies, and that will come up later. Another issue is the selective publication of antidepressant trials and its influence on apparent efficacy. Now, you can't read this chart, I hope. And here's a little blow-up, which you still can't read. But the idea basically is that papers that get submitted to the FDA tend to not look as good as papers that get published in the literature. So there's often a selection and publication bias that you can imagine with these antidepressant trials. And while we don't know for sure that's a fact with alternative treatments, there's every indication that that would be true also. And hopefully I'll talk a little bit about that as well. Now, before people go home and say they shouldn't take antidepressants, there's been a lot of work done in looking at antidepressant usage, and several large, well-respected organizations do support the use of antidepressants. There's a nice little review in the New York Times, I think Sunday Magazine from 2011 by Peter Kramer called In Defense of Antidepressants. But there's a bottom line is there's a controversy about antidepressants and how well they work. So I think it's very natural and normal, commonsensical, that we should look at alternative treatments. So the first alternative treatment, as I mentioned before, is exercise. We all love exercise. We all hate exercise, right? And this is a quote from Plato. The lack of activity destroys the good condition of every human being, while movement and methodical physical exercise save it and preserve it. So even the Greeks knew that exercise was good. That just makes sense, right? That's good for you. So here's a study, the National Comorbidity Survey, looked at a nationally representative sample of over 8,000 people, of whom over 60% reported regular physical activity. And then if you correlated that to whether they had certain psychiatric disorders, it looks like if you say you regularly exercise, your chances of developing major depression or having major depression at that time is less than 1, 75.75. Panic attacks and social phobia are also decreased. So it looks like exercise is good for depression. Are we done there? Do we have any questions at this point? Is that good enough for you? Is that what else would you, I see people shaking their heads. What else would you like to know? Anything else?
What's the ratio of population of people that don't exercise?
How common is it in the general population? What about people who don't exercise? Wendy, did you push?
The studies talk about how often and, you know, types and or anything like that.
How? What kind of exercise do people do? Yeah. Is that your question? Yeah. What kind of exercise? Why would we want to know that? Because if we want to do it, we'd want to figure that out. Anything else in the back?
Yeah. You're depressed, where do you get the motivation?
Excellent question. If you're depressed, I'm sorry, I'm going to paraphrase this in case you ever can't hear. If you're depressed, how do you get the motivation to exercise? So these are great questions. But we do see a lot of kinds of studies like this, right? If you do A, then B, then it's associated with B. So a couple of thoughts that I had, I think you've touched on them, are this is what's called a population-based epidemiological study. Basically, it shows an association with things, but not necessarily a causation. So one of the questions that I had also was regular exercise was not defined. And actually, in the study, it was only part of a larger study, and they asked individuals about whether they had certain psychiatric symptoms and so forth, and whether they met criteria for certain diagnoses. They also asked people, do you exercise regularly? And that was the and so 60% of the people said yes, that they did exercise regularly. But that was it. That's all we know about the study. That's it. So we don't know what it means to say yes to regular exercise. And then also causation is not established, only an association. Because you might consider there to be what we call a confounding factor. Has anyone heard this term before, confounding? Confounding means when there's another factor involved that might relate to both, in this example, someone who exercised regularly and then also someone who's less likely to be depressed. So, for example, if your general health is good, you might exercise more, and then you also might be less likely to be depressed. So that could be a confounding factor, that you might just be less likely to be, you might be healthier in general. Oh, and by the way, sorry to mention this earlier. Some of the slides are marked. I've had the background in a light blue. I intended those to be kind of the statistical or kind of take-home methodological slides, just so you know what I was thinking. Now, beyond the population-based epidemiological study, we want to get a more clear idea of will exercise help? Because the one I just showed you, we all had lots of questions about, and we wanted to know, what does that mean for me? So in a randomized control study or a randomized control trial, what they will do is they'll take a bunch of people and divide them up into groups and randomly assign some of the percentage of the people to intervention A and others to usually a control intervention. And then we'll get into that when I talk about the placebo effect. But in this study from 1999, they looked at 156 depressed older adults who were then randomly assigned to one of three groups. And in this study, they looked at supervised aerobic exercise, sertraline, also known as Zoloft these days, and then a combination of both aerobic exercise and then sertraline. So that what they did is they randomly assigned people to one of these three groups and then monitored them and then saw how they did after 4 months. Yes? Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. They defined older adults as 65 and older. So remission rates at 4 months, although I'm pretty sure that's the answer, but I have to look it up to be 100% sure, but I think that is the right answer. The remission rates, meaning getting better from depression at the four-month period, was 60% for the exercise group, 68% for the sertraline group, and then 65% in the exercise and the sertraline group. And for my jaundiced eye, that's about the same for all three groups. They all did about the same. So the bottom line is that they thought that exercise was effective as sertraline in treating, and I didn't go through the details of this study because we have a bunch of other studies to go through, but the individuals in this who participated in the study were mildly depressed. And so at least in this population of mildly depressed older individuals, exercise is as effective as sertraline. And they said maybe sertraline had a slightly faster initial response than exercise.
Exercise.
Okay, what did they mean by exercise? Excuse me?
Category of older.
Right.
To define that category of exercise.
What did they do in their exercise intervention is the question. So you're reading my mind, and because the next slide does define the study in terms of how much exercise did they do, because that's what I'm interested in too, right? Because I want to know if I feel not so good or what can I do to feel better, how much should I exercise? So their intervention was getting people up to 70 to 85% of maximum heart rate. And your maximum heart rate, by the way, is 220 minus your age. And then you multiply that between 70 and 85%. And what they did was people had a 10-minute warm-up, then a 30 minutes of continuous walking or jogging, and then 5 minutes of cool-down exercises. That was the intervention. So that sounds pretty good. But that, this was three times a week. I'm sorry, I should admit, this is three times a week. So now for a lazy guy like me, the question is, well, how much exercise is enough? Maybe we could get away with just, I'm hoping, the 5 minutes of warm-up exercise. And that would be good. That would be great, right? Wendy?
So some of the things that I have heard over the years is that if you cannot fit in 30 minutes worth of exercise, you do 10 minutes at a time and, you know, 3 times a day, so that is a smaller challenge than trying to fit in 45 minutes.
So the question kind of is, can you cut down the exercise into smaller little chunks? Will that be better for depression, or just as good for depression? Am I paraphrasing the question correctly? So we'll find out. So you and I are not the only people who ask this question. We're wondering, how much exercise is enough? Can we look at the efficacy and dose response? This is one that I was kind of hoping if we play ping pong or billiards, that might be enough. So in this study, a more recent study, they looked at a high-dose exercise versus a low-dose exercise. And in the low-dose intervention, individuals had to do 7 calories per kilogram per week, which I've just multiplied it out for you for a 150-pound person, is about 500 calories per week of addition to what you usually burn, obviously, but of exercise. And then they had a public health dose. I don't know why they called it that, why they couldn't just say until you cry exercise intervention, which is about 1,200 calories for a 150-pound person. So how much? And then they had about 80 patients total. And interestingly, they had a control for this study as well. And in this control, they had flexibility exercises, which took the same amount of time 3 times a week. So instead of burning off calories, people would do stretching exercises. And just for those of you who are interested, how much exercise is that? So walking, if you were at the, I think this is the low, let's see, where am I here? So this goes to show you how much time you have to do. So walking 75 minutes 3 times a week, this is the high dose, I believe, and then 60 minutes 3 times a week for jogging. So that's a pretty long time. I mean, I don't jog that much. I don't do anything that much. That's why psychiatrists have 50-minute sessions, you know. Okay. I'm not sure I want all these jokes recorded. Can I stand away from the... And this chart is also in the syllabus, so if you want to look up your own specific weight, and you can find these things online as well, but how much calories you'll burn up in 1 hour. Okay, so I want to take a poll here. So we have the low dose... 500 calories a week exercise, or the high dose, 1,200. How many of you think that the low dose was as good as the public health dose? How many think it was fine just to exercise less? All right. How many of you think it was better to exercise more in terms of depression? And how many of you are like me and wish that less exercise would be better, right? Maybe you get so exhausted you get, like, depressed from, you know. Okay, the answer is coming up here. Okay, here's the answer. So here's a graph looking at control. So we're going to talk about the rating scales in a minute. But the baseline for everyone was about 16 on this Hamilton rating scale for depression. That's mildly depressed for a psychiatrist like myself, mildly depressed. And so people who did the stretching exercises got down to about 11. Individuals who did the low dose also got down to about 11. And individuals who did the public health dose actually had a significant difference and had their ratings got down to about 8.5. So it turns out that exercising more is better for you. Any comments at this point? Shira?
I just have a question. For the older adult group, were they exercising in a group or was it individual? Because I'm wondering if there was a socialization component that added to feeling better as well.
I'm going to repeat. Do you mind if I repeat that? Just to repeat the comments. The comment was, and I think it was an excellent one. She's wondering is, were these exercises done in a group? Because it's a lot of fun to get together with other people and even stretch or hang out together. And that could have a great deal of antidepressant activity itself. Yes, these were done in groups. So you could see, and I'll talk a little bit about that also, about how the mechanism of how exercise might work. But that has, I think that's an excellent observation. The control people did flexibility exercises 3 times a week to make them more similar. Now, let's see, where am I? The other question came up is, I don't know if you said it this way, but what kind of depressed person exercises, right? That's not normally what we do. And so this is a flow graph from this study, actually. And it turns out that they actually assessed over 1,600 people, and they screened them through various different things. As I mentioned, the generalizability of the study. You sometimes have to look at how many people they screened. They actually wound up with only 95 people eligible out of the 1,600 people that they initially screened. And out of the 95, 15 refused to participate. So we're down to 80 people who are actually willing to participate in an intervention where they might exercise a lot. That's depressing. So one of the caveats when you do studies about exercise, and this is a challenge, where did these individuals come from? They had to pre-screen 1,600 people to get 80. So that's a big caveat to think about. So the question is, and I'm only going to review a couple of different studies here because we have other things to talk about, but I'm going to also talk about a systematic review. And this is something that I might read or other doctors often read to get kind of an overview of an area. So what happens is there's an institution called the Cochrane Reviews, and they fund a bunch of different, mostly very intelligent people without a lot of conflicts of interest, to go and read all the papers in this area and come up with some conclusions. And they're often quite good, often very detailed and statistically rigorous, and also therefore quite lengthy. But in this Cochrane Review of Exercise for Depression, they concluded that exercise does improve depressive symptoms. It's unclear by how much, and you probably have to continue to exercise to maintain the benefit. So that's not a huge leap of faith there, but I think that's a good conclusion. Now, how does exercise work? And there have been a number of different hypotheses. One is monoamines are neurotransmitters, so serotonin, for those of you who have heard of different kinds of serotonin, and norepinephrine are monoamines, and exercise may help modulate monoamines. They may help regulate with the hormonal regulation in individuals. And as we all, but many of us have heard that exercise releases endorphins. So that also can have an antidepressant effect. In addition,
excuse me, is that, do you mean regulate serotonin or increase serotonin?
The question is, does it regulate serotonin or increase serotonin? The role of serotonin in depression is a little bit complicated, so I'm going to hedge my bets and just say regulate, which could include increasing it, but I would just say regulate, because increasing serotonin itself probably is not enough to cause an antidepressant effect. There probably is some sort of regulation that, by increasing it, probably helps in some way, but it's not directly that. I'm sorry, thank you. Question?
I'm just wondering if the exercise, is it only going to work for certain degrees of depression? Like, is it only for less severe depression? Or would it continue to work for severe degrees?
The question would be is exercise good for only mild depression or also for severe depression as well? How much of that has been factored in? We don't know. The answer is we don't know. Most of the studies to date have looked at people with mild to moderate depression. In fact, that's true for most of the alternative treatments that I've looked at, that they're usually tried on individuals who have mild to moderate depression. And that's an important thing to think about, because I'll go into that as I'll go into in a minute.
Because this is going to come up, I'm sure, more, can you give us some notion of what you mean by mild to moderate depression?
I'll, we'll get to that. Thank you. How do you define mild or moderate depression versus severe depression? Last question, I'm going to move on.
I'm confused because I'm not really sure what depression is. So when these people say they're mildly depressed and they test them and then afterwards they say they're less depressed, so therefore exercise works. I mean, the subplot here is I'd like to get out and exercise it.
Right.
Can you measure the opposite of depression as happiness? Can you measure happiness?
Can we measure happiness? How do we define depression? I didn't want to go into like the detailed description of how to define depression today, but I will talk about these depression rating scales. And the definition of depression is, while there's definitely wiggle room in how one diagnoses it as a psychiatrist, there it is laid out to some degree. And all in the studies that I mentioned, usually individuals are diagnosed with depression, and then the severity of the depression is based on a rating scale, which I'll go into momentarily. The diagnosis of depression is usually something that is done by a psychiatrist or a mental health professional in most of the studies. Except in the first study that I mentioned, which was an epidemiological survey, they did diagnose depression based on individuals who were lay people who gave the interviews. Now, how does exercise work? And someone mentioned the social interaction hypothesis. You could also postulate that you are distracted from your problems, you start to feel better about yourself, you feel more mastery over yourself, and all those could be true and probably are true to some extent. I wouldn't rule out any, just one does not exclude the others. I like the, if you play soccer, you might break your bottle of vodka theory of depression. So the downside of exercise, the downsides of exercise is if exercise were medication, it actually would not receive FDA approval for the treatment of depression. It doesn't meet the criteria that the FDA would need to approve. And as you've mentioned, as we've discussed, it's easy to say, but it's not easy to do. On the other hand, we have to still encourage people to exercise, not only for mental health reasons, but for cardiovascular reasons. I think in some ways, the evidence for cardiovascular fitness is better than for depression. Again, I haven't reviewed the cardiovascular issues, but it's clearly useful for lowering your blood pressure, decreasing, improving cardiovascular health. So these are just some tips on how to start exercising. Anticipating barriers, like knowing what kinds of things are going to get in the way, and not letting them stop you. Sometimes just trying them and working your way, fudging your way around them. Keeping your expectations realistic. Every talk of mine has to have a picture of Jeremy Lillian now. Keeping expectations realistic. My son, who's 10 years old, he says to me, he's 10, he says, "Hey, Dad, how do you say A minus in Chinese?" I'm like, "What?" He goes, "F." I'm like, "Ugh." I said to myself, I said, "You know, that's kind of a stereotype that you're fostering there. But we'll discuss it. We'll discuss this after you finish studying for your MCATs, okay?" All right. Step counters. So the idea is building up or developing an exercise log. Keeping a log should be this. And a good way to do that, I think, are pedometers or step counters. This helps you quantify how much exercise you're doing. There's this goal out there of 10,000 steps a day, which is pretty ambitious for most people. That's 5 miles a day, which is very ambitious. There has been a study looking, if you do this, you will lower your blood pressure. That's because you don't have time to do anything else. But the way to really do it is you find your average over time, and then you try to increase it gradually. You gradually increase the amount of steps you do on a daily or weekly basis so that you don't find yourself exhausted or flustered or frustrated because you can't get to 10,000 steps a day. And then finally, the key is to just start. There may be obstacles and things, but give it a try. So the bottom line for exercise, and I'm not going to be able to go in front of a whole bunch of people and say, "Don't exercise." That's just not realistic, right? I wish I could, because then it would be very controversial. But I do think that exercise is good for mild to moderate depression. The exercise should get your heart rate up. Ideally, it should be 3 to 5 times a week. And if you do 5 times a week with shorter increments, I think that's probably just as good. And exercise is good for you on so many other levels that it really is an excellent recommendation. So it's good for your heart, immune function, brain, helps you sleep better. All those things are good for you. And if anyone needs more information on exercise, uptodate.com has some nice info there. And just as a review, the statistical concepts that are reviewed in this section are, is there or what is the intervention? Be careful when you look at studies, the difference between causality versus an association. Most studies can only show association. It's very hard to prove something causes something else. And then the importance of confounding that can impair study reliability or validity. Placebos. That's my next topic. How many of you have taken a placebo in the last week or so? Now, by the way, contrary to popular belief, people often ask me, do you use placebos? Physicians in the United States are not allowed to prescribe placebos without your knowledge. So, now, believe it or not, doing that would probably still work to some extent, even if you knew. Now, this is a kind of placebo. And this is a quote I like. My friend, drop all your preconceived and fixed ideas and be neutral. Do you know why this cup is useful? Because it is empty. And that's a Taoist saying. So, and it's kind of remotely related to placebos, I think. So it turns out that adherence to placebo is associated with decreased mortality overall. Isn't that a strange finding? Now, that's a good example of maybe there's a confounder in there. People who take placebos reliably are people who are very conscientious about taking pills, taking good care of themselves in general. So if you looked at studies and people who take the medications, even if they're placebos, are less likely to die or have an adverse health outcome than people who don't take placebos regularly. Does that make sense? So there's a confounder in there. It's not that placebos probably actually decrease directly mortality. It's that there's a confounder in there. Okay, so this gets back to the question of how well do interventions work for more severe depression versus mild depression? And this holds true for exercise and many other interventions. In this graph here, this dotted green or gray line here represents the effect of placebo based on how severe the depression is. So you can see the more severe the depression is, the less well placebos work, it turns out. And all the way back to, if you're not depressed at all, placebos work quite well. It actually makes sense, right? And similar with meds, it's the other way around. If you are more severely depressed, although the effect plateaus out for antidepressants, you only get the same amount of improvement after moderate depression on here. You get the same amount of improvement no matter what, but the difference between the drug and the placebo gets greater. And then all the way to the point of, if you're not depressed, antidepressants probably make you feel worse than placebo. So again, you can see how that factors in. So at the level of, and this is again the Hamilton rating scale for depression, which is the most common rating scale for depression, at a rating scale of about 16, you don't see any difference, and in fact placebo begins to work better than medications for very mild depression. And to give you an idea of what's, so this is just another example of, this is a, with pooling together all these different studies that had drugs and placebos, over 36,000 people, antidepressants gave a response rate of a little over 50%, and placebo gave a response rate of a little over 37%. Is there a question up there?
Is time a co-founder in here, like the length of
That's a great question. So is time a confounder also? Most studies for antidepressants are 8-week studies. And most of the studies I will cite to you are, in my mind, a shorter term studies, which are also about 8 weeks or less. And that's a very important thing because then placebos, another mechanism begins to come into play. And that mechanism is called regression to the mean, which I'll talk about in a moment. This is a study looking at 728 patients. Again, you see the key is the difference between the medication and the placebo. So that's how much extra oomph you're getting. I'm going to take a little tangent here, and using this blue slide is there's this thing here called the p-value. And this is, what is the p meaning is equal to 0.005? How many of you know what a p-value is? Can I see a raise of hand or have some idea of what it is? I'm going to give a shot at defining it. I'm not a great statistician myself. But a p-value is whenever you see a difference in any results, it could be just by luck. So what you can do is estimate based on the number of people in the study and how big the difference is, and using statistical methods, you can calculate a p-value. And the p-value says, what is the likelihood that these two numbers are different just by luck? So the likelihood that these two numbers are different just by luck, and in this case it's 0.005, is 5 out of 1,000 that this is just by luck. So probably it's not just by luck, that this is, represents a true difference. So that's my definition of a p-value. Here's another example here. If you have group 1, you can see you have a bunch of numbers here. Their average here is 2.04, and you have a bunch of numbers here, and this is 1.76. What's the likelihood that these two numbers are just randomly, just by luck, this number tends to be smaller than this number than these numbers? And so if, let's say, we had a p-value of 0.001, that would mean there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that this is by luck. This is probably a truly bigger number than this. And this example is, this is the height of my basketball team when I was in the youth league in high school, and this is the height of the New York Knicks. In meters. So it turns out that's not by luck that they're taller. They got. So how do placebos work? So we looked at this number here, and we have 35% placebo response rate. What are some of the mechanisms by which placebos might work? Here's some imaging of brains, looking at people who've taken medications versus placebos. Which I can't interpret this for you at all. But what the article says is that, and demonstrates pretty convincingly, that people who respond to placebo when they're depressed actually show similar brain changes than people who respond when they're on medications. So whether you respond because of placebo or because of medication, same brain changes occur. In this early study, and this has been known for a while, the mechanism of placebo analgesia. Now, analgesia refers to pain relief. So it turns out that placebos, if you give someone a placebo, or you say there's a chance you can take a placebo, or you might be getting, say, morphine, then we're going to put your hand in ice-cold water, how much pain relief will you feel? And it turns out that you do get pain relief from a placebo, and that a medication that can block opiates, called naloxone, will also block the placebo effect for analgesia. Am I explaining that correctly? Meaning that when you take a placebo, probably there may be some endogenous or internal brain release of enkephalins or endorphins that can cause analgesia or pain relief. And that mechanism would be blocked by medication that blocks morphine, is called naloxone. So there's actually a biochemical description or mechanism for placebos to work. Placebos are not nothing in many drug trials. So in this study, again back to this study, the visits plus the placebo account for 78% of the response, even in the drug group. So if you think of it this way, even for people on medications, a lot of it is accounted for medication clinic visits. Now, one thing to realize is when you participate in one of these studies, the average participant in an 8-week trial spends about 20 hours being examined by top experts and highly trained caregivers. And I know in my department, the research associates are very enthusiastic and they're outstanding. I feel less depressed being around them. It's great. So you can see participating in these trials alone is actually quite a social endeavor. And you can imagine that someone makes sure your parking is all set up, you get a bag lunch very frequently. It's not a bad deal, you know? Now, this is a tough one. Does anyone know who this is? Any guesses? You're never going to get this. It's Jacob Bernoulli. And anyone knows who this is? This is even harder. How did everyone know? Sir Francis Galt. How did you know that? Oh, it's on the picture in the handout. He gave the talk last week, and so... He was Charles Darwin's cousin. And Bernoulli was very interested in the behavior of large groups of numbers. And Sir Francis Galt had noted, you know, was a cousin of Charles Darwin. For example, one of his things that he noted was that if people are very tall people, the odds that their children would be tall are actually less. I mean, they're going to be maybe tall, but they're not going to be as tall as their parents. And the mechanism for that is regression to the mean. Basically, if you have a truly random event, random events, over time, you're going to get regression back to the average. Just by if you add up enough events. So from a clinical point of view, so if you're a doctor, what that means is if someone comes into you, like, and this is, let's say, their mood over the course of weeks or months, this is the natural history of someone's mood, patients come to see you at this point. They don't come to see you at this point when they're starting to feel better. They come to see you when they're feeling their worst. And then, so therefore, by the law of regression to the mean, by averages, they're going to just feel better over time. So no matter what you do here, you're in good shape because oftentimes they'll feel better, you know? And ideally, to be quite honest, physicians are trained to, hopefully we try to get some experience and training to learn when is this going to keep going? What are the signs that this is not at the very worst? When are the signs a person's going to keep going down? So we have to be trained to, when are we dealing with regression to the mean and when are we not? That's an important factor. So this is, again, keeping expectations realistic. And how many of you heard of the Sports Illustrated cover jinx? Jinx? Like, the idea is once you're on the cover, you're going to have a bad series of playing because you statistically were lucky enough to get on the cover, and then you are more likely to have a bad week or so just because of regression to the mean. That's called the jinx. But what we may be witnessing is regression to the mean. Now, of course, we all know that Jeremy Lin made it to the next cover, so we'll see how it happens. So the bottom line is that placebos are potent, and they're not nothing. And if you look at any study, make sure you look at the placebo or the control intervention very carefully. Because a lot of times there's a lot of stuff going on in that you may not realize. Okay, let me move on. Yes?
How do psychiatrists use placebo as an active treatment?
How do psychiatrists use placebo as an active treatment? Like I said, we can't prescribe placebos. Everything we do has to be above board. I don't know if we would use placebos, but the idea of all the other elements of placebos one tries to maximize. So we do know that, like, paying attention to people makes a huge difference. It does for me. We really try to maximize all the other things that go along that I mentioned with treatments, such as, well, I'm not going to click all the way there, but such as expectancy, making sure we listen carefully to people, providing as much possibility for improvement as possible. I guess that would be my answer to you. Question?
Taken into account in studies, the patient's participation is a desire to get better. And in some cases, you may have patients who the depression is their comfort zone. And
right.
So they don't necessarily want to get better. And so did they take into account the fact that people willing to participate in the study have kind of, a psychological edge in a sense, where when we're talking about the placebo effect, part of the whole point of the placebo effect is that we have tremendous ability to affect our own biochemistry through our own psychology.
Right. So the question is, or the comment, I would say, no, that's excellent. I'm going to try to paraphrase it because it's an excellent comment. It's just that how much do we factor in patients' own expectancy of success, maybe, or how much are they motivated to get better? That obviously is going to be a big impact in terms of prognosis. And actually, there have been studies looking at this. How likely do you think it is that you are getting better? How likely do you think is that you got the active intervention, in fact, has also been looked at? And people who think that they got the intervention, people who feel like there's a good chance they're going to get better, are more likely to get better. So that's another way which we try to enhance outcomes. So omega-3 fatty acids. How many of you have already heard about omega-3 fatty acids? Okay, so I won't be going through it. And I like this quote too, another Taoist quote. Govern a great nation as you would cook a small fish. Do not overdo it. It's my political comment for the evening. So fatty acid biochemistry, I'm not going to go into the details of this. Fatty acids are acids with kind of fat attached to them. Some are short, some are long. Omega-3, and how many people have had like college-level organic chemistry? Okay, this is the one time it might even possibly come into play in your life. Okay? So there's omega-3 fatty acids and omega-6 fatty acids. And it turns out that we are mostly omega-6 fatty acids. And the way we omega-3s are at this 3 position here is the first double bond. And at this 6 position is the first double bond here. And so this is arachidonic acid. This is, I'm going to call it EPA. And this is the good stuff. I won't go into the details of this because it's probably not critical that we all understand this in great detail, but that the balance of omega-3s versus omega-6s is important. It's involved in brain cell membranes. The second messenger systems in the brain utilize these things. And the other key thing is as animals, we can't change the ratios of omega-6s to omega-3s except by what we eat. Like other organisms, algae, can change that internally, but as animals, we cannot. So the question is, what balance do we get in terms of omega-3s versus omega-6s? Now, it turns out that in the old days, Fred and Wilma Flintstone, it was relatively high in omega-3s because they ate a lot of leafy greens, nuts, and fruits. Occasionally, they'd have lean game animals or bugs, and fish is where you get omega-3 fatty acids. The modern Western diet is typified by Homer eating a donut. It's high in omega-6s. We only rarely eat nuts, fruits, and veggies. We are more likely to eat cultivated grains. Our oil comes from vegetables or corn-fed animals, the fat from corn-fed animals, cows, pigs, or poultry. So fat from fish has a lot of omega-3s. Other fats are omega-6s. Now, if you look at the literature, there's tons of studies about eating more fish is good for you. Comparing across countries, eating fish is correlated. Note the word correlated, associated with lower rates of depression in individuals. It's correlated with having more omega-3s in the body is correlated with less depression. And there have been a lot of studies with small n's. And this term N means the number of subjects. That's the way statisticians say people, N. And you could see in these studies, they're small N's, and they did show 4, I think, basically positive results. And then there were 2 negative studies that didn't show a difference between people who took a lot of omega-3s. And one of the other side issues with omega-3 fatty acids is this complicated issue of whether EPA or DHA is better. So omega-3s come in 2 flavors, EPA or DHA, and I'll just give you the answer now. EPA is thought to be the answer or the better of the omega-3s. In a more recent study, which had a lot of people, this looked at individuals who were already on standard antidepressants and added on omega-3 supplementation. And this is one of the few studies in this area that I could find that had a large N. And they actually did the right amount of EPA, meaning a lot of EPA, not as much DHA. And they took this daily for 8 weeks versus placebo. And the answers are there was a mean difference between the active and the placebo of 1.3 on the rating scale. And then they did a sub-analysis that patients without anxiety disorders had a 3.17 difference, so maybe a slightly higher difference. But then the question is what's the difference? So these numbers are statistically significant, and actually this number is not statistically significant. But what's the difference between statistically significant and clinically significant? What does it mean to get a 3-point lower score on these depression scales? Now, the most common depression scale is the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale, or the HAM-D. And there are a bunch of other, in my mind, actually better rating scales, but since we started with the HAM-D, this is what's used historically, and that's what you'll see for most studies. Some of these other ones are probably better and easier to do. But the HAM-D, and I have the slide, but I don't know if you can read it, but it asks you 21 questions, and you can get a score of up to 63. And so a typical question would be, so for number one, as a clinician, you're supposed to rate the individual on their depressed mood, sadness, hopelessness, helpless, worthless, and how severe is this person on a scale of 0 to 4? So if the person only says that they're depressed all the time and they don't talk about anything else, then they would get a 4. If the person says, only if you ask them really carefully, do they, maybe I'm a little depressed, then they would get a 1. But, and that's probably the most, this is the most non-specific question. There's a bunch of other questions, and like I said, there's 21, and they ask about things of weight loss, how much do you understand of being you're ill, how slowed down the person is, how much problem do they have with sleeping, how much anxiety do they have. So you could see on up to a 63. So my general rule of thumb would be that on a bad day, we all might score about a 10. That might be a bad day for us. We might complain about some of these things, or 12. And so a mean difference of 1.3 points is really negligible. And even this of 3 is a relatively small amount. So when you read a study, be careful. They may say there's an association with, but you want to see how big a deal is it. I think there was an article today in the New York Times about, did anyone see it, about omega-3 fatty acids? Was that right? Omega-3 being associated with smaller brain volumes. It was a Wall Street Journal. Smaller brain volumes. But I mean, how much smaller? If it's only going to be a little bit, I may not make that much of a difference. But having said that, omega-3 fatty acids are probably good for you on a number of different levels. Again, like exercise, for cardiovascular health, as well as mental health. So if you do want to take omega-3s, the risks, I think, are pretty minimal. There was some concern years ago about toxins like mercury being in fish and stuff, but most of the compounds have been cleared up of that. And you want to get the omega-3 fatty acids that come from smaller fish. Bleeding is a very remote possibility. There's some theoretical possibility that it might increase bleeding a little bit, but that may not necessarily be a big risk. And then the biggest, most common thing is people have is fish burp, meaning that when you take these pills, if you burp, you'll have a little fishy taste. And you can get rid of that, actually. I have a little slide on this. They're enterocoded kinds. If you store the capsules in the freezer and pop them, they'll be frozen, and then they'll go down faster. If you take it with food, and some of them now have lemon oil added as well. So, if you look at the dosing for depression, you want to look at like this kind of a slide. You want to see how much EPA. So this has 150 milligrams of EPA versus 100 milligrams of DHA. So to get the same amount in that study, you'd need to take 70 of these pills a day. They're not huge, but that's a significant number, 7 of these pills a day to get the same number as in that study. The problem with being a vegetarian or vegan in this situation is that flaxseed, it does not have the correct amount of EPA, really. And flaxseed oil, which is alpha-linoleic acid, does not get converted to EPA or DHA, really. And we have no randomized controlled trials of flax oils in mood disorder. Algae is where omega-3s come from. I don't know if I haven't heard of any composition where people could eat algae directly, but that would make the most sense. Okay, so just as a reminder, I talked in this kind of portion about how to measure depression and what does significant mean from a statistical versus a clinical. And sometimes to read these studies, therefore, you need the help of someone who has some experience reading these, who's familiar with the rating scales in order to decipher, is this a meaningful number or not? Okay, so the bottom line for omega-3 fatty acids is efficacy as a supplement for depression is a maybe, I would say. the risks are trivial, and so the additional benefits are likely. So I think it's worth it to, if you want to eat more fish and you feel like you you probably should. So I would consider giving it a try. Sammy, we all know who this is, right? Sammy. Now, Sammy is considered a food supplement. Now, I don't know how many foods you eat that look like this, but it is a food supplement, and it stands for Sammy is S-adenosyl methionine, and from now on, I'm just going to say Sammy. And it doesn't look like a food in that it comes in these bottles and is formulated in pills. And it is involved in a rather complex series of biochemical pathways. And I'm going to skip these unless you guys really want. So the early studies were mostly done intravenously. And it was only recently that they were, last few years, that they were able to make a composition of SAMe that was stable that you could take orally. And in one of the first of these studies, they looked at 15 inpatients with depression who had HAMD scores in the high 20s. And they took 800 milligrams twice a day for this three-week trial. And they did show a difference here. So placebo is in the dark circles here, and SAMe is in these open circles here. So you could see that it does seem to be better than placebo. But it's a very small study, about 15 inpatients. And again, so some of the things that we talked about in terms of trials come into play. So I looked at a large review by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. There's a review of 25 studies that compared SAMe with conventional antidepressants. Most of the studies looked at intravenous dosing. They concluded that SAMe was associated with an improvement of approximately 6 points in the HAM-D score. So that's not too bad. I think that would rate as good as many antidepressants. This is a similar study where patients are already on conventional antidepressants again. This is more recent. And 73 patients who were then randomized to get either SAMe or placebo. And if you look at the response rates or the remission rates, or now response refers to if you were to take the HAM-D score and get a 50% reduction. So the person may not be all the way better, but they are a lot better. That's called the response. And remission is usually when the patient scores an 8 or less on the HAM-D, so that's a much better. So if you look at placebo, the rates aren't as good as the rates for SAMe. But one caveat I would have is just that the numbers are still rather small. So let me talk to you about the problems with the small sample size. Now, there was this interesting... How many of you read Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow? So do you recommend it? It's an excellent book. So he cites this study, which showed an incidence of kidney cancer in the over 3,000 counties in the United States. And interestingly, counties in which the incidence of kidney cancer that was the lowest were mostly rural counties, were sparsely populated, and located in traditional Republican states in the Midwest, the South, and the West. So any thoughts about what you might think would be an interesting thing to follow up on in this kind of study? What would be some of the things you might think about? What comes to mind?
Gunpowder.
People who might be getting kidney cancer, they shoot them. And so, you know, what would... How does gunpowder factor into this?
Diet.
It's lower.
But it's lower in these areas.
Well, those people don't live as long, so they don't get a chance.
Those people don't live as long. This is being filmed here in San Francisco, by the way. So these are people.
The consumption of the foods they're eating, they might be getting more. If they're in a more rural area,
yeah,
they might be eating more greens. They might be eating more food fresh from the gardens.
Right.
Also lower stress levels.
Right. So maybe they're in the fresh air. They get cleaner food, cleaner water, and they have. A healthier lifestyle. Now, interestingly, you can look also at the incidence of kidney cancer that had the highest incidence, the counties that had the highest incidence of kidney cancer, and it's the same list, it turns out. It's mostly rural, sparsely populated, and located in traditional Republican states. So it turns out really the issue is, it's not the Republican thing, no. It's that they're sparsely populated is the real factor. And the way that plays into it is that when you have smaller numbers, as in a small, less densely populated county, you have greater variability in the final result. So kidney cancer is a very uncommon disease, not uncommon enough, but relatively uncommon. And so you only need a few people either to get kidney cancer or not to get kidney cancer to change the result dramatically in a sparsely populated county. So counties that have larger numbers of people, a few people here or there, they're going to have less variability overall in terms of the overall incidence. Does that make sense? In a strange way, it's actually a kind of regression to the mean is actually in play here as well. It's just that since kidney cancer takes place over such a long period of time, we don't see it. If we followed the counties that had the highest or the lowest incidence of kidney cancer over 100 or 200 years, we might see their incidence going back to the mean. So that's one of the issues with many studies that we saw with the publication bias. If you have lots of little studies, one, the studies that don't show anything may not get published. Academicians don't get a lot of, laurels or awards for publishing, finding results that are negative. Like, oh, I did this great study. It showed that Sammy didn't do anything. That doesn't get you a lot. So those studies may not get published. So what you're getting is then a bias in terms of selection of publications. So the main problem with SAMe is there are no studies with large sample sizes. It also, since if it were regulated by the FDA as a drug, would not get FDA approval for depression.
Have there been any studies about taking SAMe along with an antidepressant?
Yeah, the studies, the last study was a study looking at SAMe as augmentation with antidepressants already. So that's a good question. That's one that many people have asked. The side effects, insomnia, anxiety, GI upset, they're not serious, but they do occur, and they probably occur, in my mind, about the same incidence as antidepressants. I didn't have this on the list, but it occurs at about the same incidence as antidepressants. Wendy?
So the first two of those factors are also already related to depression. So,
right.
Or anxiety, or both. And the GI upset, stuff like that. So, how does that help? I have anxiety, and you're taking this for your benefit, but then you're.
Right. The question is sometimes people, when they have depression, they have insomnia, anxiety, and GI upset. If we take a medication that causes those side effects, that would seem to be counterproductive. That's an excellent question. It's actually a little different talk about how to select antidepressants based on type of depression or the symptoms that the person's demonstrating. That's a slightly different talk that I do at some point if you're ever interested. But I won't get into it here. But the main idea is that even though you do have a medication that causes these side effects, it can still help you with depression. So ideally, the side effects don't occur as frequently as the effect does.
Do you have anything on what percentage of the people taking this actually have those side effects? Only a percentage of the population not
them. Right. And let's face it, some of us may have these things on placebo also, like insomnia, anxiety, GI upset, that happens not common. So when you look at studies, you want to look at the side effect incidence also. I don't remember it for this study exactly, but I do know that it occurred with some frequency. The number of subjects, is relatively small. So it's hard to tell how common it is. You need to get hundreds of people to actually look at how common these side effects. I would say that it probably does occur with some frequency, not all the time, and usually not super severe also. If you feel these things, you can stop the medication. The other issue is the cost of SAMe, which is about, I just looked this up on Amazon, that's about $60 a month. And so just the bottom line, I actually would guess that it probably, I wouldn't bet everything on it. It probably works as well as conventional antidepressants. I don't have any evidence to say that it doesn't. The typical dosage is about 800 milligrams twice a day. The main disadvantage is cost. But overall, the research is still rather limited. And again, if this were not a nutritional supplement and it were actually a drug, it definitely would not be approved by the FDA. And so you're not getting any monitoring by a physician if you take SAMe as well. An older picture of Sammy.
Instead of drug interaction, what about food supplement interactions? Are there any problems with Sammy and DHA, EPA, and, you know, can you overdose all of these?
Are there interactions with other interactions with the different nutraceuticals or nutritional supplements? The answer is we really don't know, because they aren't tested in the same way that medications and drugs are tested. So we really don't know. We only know by hearsay, for example. The FDA does, I believe, collect reports. If people have side effects to SAMe, they will get reports over time and then be able to issue an alert if something serious comes up. But we don't have systematic data about what happens if you take SAMe versus these other things.
Prescription medications would say don't take something
right. Right. Most nutritional supplements have a strange caveat of like, this is not intended to do anything, basically. So you gotta wonder about that.
Question? You mentioned it's not monitored by a physician. So when someone is on an antidepressant, typically if they are trying to wean off of that, that's done very carefully.
Correct.
Do you have any comment on if one is on SAMe, how or what the effects might be if they were to wean off of SAMe?
So the comment is most people who are on antidepressants, I as a psychiatrist would recommend going down slowly over time and not to end cold turkey. I think that's a general wise advice for anything you do. So I would say that that's probably what holds true for SAMe, but I really don't know. You know,
you've not seen any studies on that.
I've not seen any studies about SAMe withdrawal or anything like that. It's not backed by large pharmaceutical company, which has its benefits in some ways. The downside is we don't have like the rigorous trials that would that would get to the FDA for the FDA scrutiny. Let me move along here. So I'm just going to summarize here, and then we can take some more questions here at the end. We're getting to a little bit over 1 hour mark here. So I reviewed exercise, placebos, omega-3 fatty acids, and SAMe. I'll go over them in just a moment. The statistical concepts I just want to review with you briefly here. We talked about the different types of studies. So when you're looking at studies or interventions, it's important to examine what kind it is. The first kind was the epidemiological, large population-based studies. Those are good for hypotheses, but they don't really tell you if an intervention itself is going to be good for you or in general, because there can be many confounders and problems with epidemiological studies.
Could you repeat that last sentence?
Repeat the last sentence. There are many problems with epidemiological studies in terms of telling you what to do, because there can be confounders. The best epidemiological studies can do is give you an association. So what we really want to see are randomized controlled studies with a large N, meaning lots of subjects, like 200, 500 subjects. Those would be ideal to find out if this intervention really works. The problem with those kinds of things, it's sometimes hard to develop the intervention to tell us all the things we want to know. So, for example, in the exercise module, we didn't really know exactly how much exercise to do. We can't do an intervention for every single possibility, so it's very hard to know in that case. And if we don't have a good randomized controlled study, sometimes we can take a lot of little studies and add them together and do things that are called systematic reviews and meta-analyses. And if done well, they can help a lot in terms of understanding the bottom line about interventions. The other statistical concepts I discussed were making sure you understood what the intervention was, the difference between causality and association. Most studies can only give you an association, not a cause, and the problems with confounding. We talked about a p-value. So whenever you see that p-value, you now know that that means the likelihood that the difference between these two numbers are by luck alone. So the smaller the p-value, the better. Usually you want to see a p-value of less than 0.05 by convention. So less than 0.05 means less than a 1 in 20 chance by luck that these two numbers are different. Regression to the mean is a very important concept when you're dealing with large numbers, how placebos might work, when do people see doctors, it's usually here, and then if they regress to the mean, they get better, and we look good. Here we go. The difference between clinically significant and statistically significant, this is very important to therefore understand what the rating instrument for the studies are. And so sometimes for that, you really do need someone who's familiar with that particular rating scale. The problems with a small size, sample size, which I mentioned earlier, which in a way is a kind of regression to the mean problem. It's another aspect of it. Okay, so let me just wrap up with a quick review of the different interventions. Exercise, you want to gradually build up your confidence. You should assess your personal barriers. Keep an exercise log and use a step counter to help you begin that log. It's probably good for you on lots of different levels, both physically and mentally. Placebos. There are a lot of different mechanisms to placebos. Whenever you read a study, make sure you understand what the control intervention is. That can be very helpful to help you understand the study. Placebos can work based on regression to the mean, expectancy, biochemical means too, the social aspect of having people come together. So placebos are more than just a pill, usually. Omega-3 fatty acids. The bottom line is eating fish is good for you. It's probably not a particularly strong antidepressant. SAMe, my bottom line for that is basically a medication. So exercise, do it. Placebo, it's free. Omega-3 fatty acids are probably good for you. And SAMe is $60 a month. This is a quote from Olive Schreiner. My feeling is that there is nothing in life but refraining from hurting others and comforting those that are sad. Some people have said that I'm ignorant and apathetic. To those I say, I don't know and I don't care. Man. So I'll take a couple of questions on other things. Benefits of omega-3 fatty acids is for cognitively, there's been, and cardio, I can't say much more than that they're good for your brain in terms of probably decreases the risk of dementia and good for your heart and blood vessels. Now, I'm not sure if it's due to the fact that it works directly on the brain, but also because if it's better for your blood vessels, you know, little strokes can impair brain functioning over time too. So if you keep your blood vessels in good shape in your brain, that's good for it too. Question in the back?
For the last one, the SAMe, does it seem to continue to work after you've been taking it for a while, or does it only work while you're taking it?
Oh, that's a great question. The question is if you take SAMe, do you need to keep taking it, or does it stop working once you stop taking it? It turns out that for most antidepressants, you need to keep taking it. The thing with SAMe is we don't have any studies looking at long-term usage, so we don't really know. But my guess would be once you stop taking it, you may lose the benefit once you stop taking it. Okay, one more, and then we'll stop, and I can answer questions up here.
On the cover of Harper's Magazine, there's an article about fasting curing every illness or
the world. So the question is fasting. What is it good for depression as an alternative? I have not actually done much research into that, but I agree with you. It's on the cover of Harper's, and I find it really interesting because I do know that fasting, at least for in patients with eating disorders, for example, causes a whole cascade of biochemical changes, including the release of endorphins. So it's a very interesting thing. I don't know if I would recommend it as a treatment for depression, though. So, but thank you for asking. Okay, we'll stop there, and I'll take some questions after. You.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.